Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Hey, everyone. I'm Zach Crouch.
And I'm Michael Walsh.
Welcome back to the Landmark Recovery Radio podcast. Also, we've made it to 2022. Thank God. That's a relief. So a couple quick housekeeping items. If you've been listening to our podcast for a while, or maybe this is your first time with us, we'd really, really appreciate it if you left us a review. We've had some great guests on the show lately, and we have more planned for the next few months. We would greatly appreciate it if you left a review, but we want to know your questions and feedback too. So DM us on social media with your questions or any topics you'd like to hear more about. And you can find us at Landmark Recovery on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and TikTok. On a similar note, here at Landmark Recovery, we are a growing network of drug and alcohol treatment centers with the mission to unlock human potential and a vision to save 1 million lives over the next 100 years. And with that, one of our many goals is to educate and raise awareness about the disease of addiction. Recently, we launched Sober Facts, a new video series about substance use disorders and the science behind addiction. Sober Facts is a resource answering questions about drugs informed by over a century of scientific understanding, evidence-based medicine, and the study of addiction. Check that out on our YouTube channel at Landmark Recovery. Speaking of the science behind addiction, today we have special guest Dr. Jason Kirby. Dr. Kirby serves as the Chief Medical Officer for Landmark Recovery and Praxis by Landmark Recovery. He is an expert in population health policy and is dual board certified in addiction medicine and family medicine. Dr. Kirby also is a fellow of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, or ASAM, serving on both its financial committee and level of care committee. He's also a faculty member of ASAM's Treatment of Opioid Use Disorder courses. He previously served as Medical Director of Addiction and Recovery Services at St. Peter's Health Partners in Albany, New York, and practiced at St. Peter's Hospital as the Chief of Behavioral Health. Prior to that, Dr. Kirby served as Medical Director for Gateway Rehabilitation Center and Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield's Medical Management and Policy Division. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Glad you're here. So, you know, the thing that I like to always ask the question to any guest is, what makes you passionate about working with this population of people? Because it's I don't know what the word would be. It's a tough racket working with people who have substance use problems, you know, mental health issues, combined trauma, etc. Kind of what gets you going each morning to work with these folks?
Well, I appreciate that, Zach. And I, you know, it's, you know, folks with substance use disorders are super, super complex and can be absolutely challenging. 100%. I think the thing for me, and I'm going to give you two different answers. I'm going to give you the resume answer, what I put on my CV, and I'm going to give you the real life answer. My resume answer.
I know which one is, I want to hear.
My resume answer is, you know, I'm board certified in family medicine. I did my residency training in Pittsburgh in family medicine, but I spent the majority of my early career doing emergency medicine. And so a lot of times, you know, and we were in Western Pennsylvania, very, very close to the epidemic epicenter, which is in West Virginia. And, you know, it was every day. People were coming in for opioid overdose withdrawals from the field, opioid overdose reversals in the field. And sometimes twice, sometimes three times a day, folks were coming in, and it was just nonstop. And there wasn't a whole lot of treatment options. I didn't really know much about treatment from my residency. I didn't know much about the behavioral health world or what was really done. All I knew is that they came into the emergency room. It was my job to stabilize them and then figure out where they're going to go from there. And I always did kind of find it frustrating, you know, from a lot of different aspects. You know, I, you know, I would get them stable and then send either discharge them to home or admit them to the hospital or send them to treatment. I had no clue what happened to them, at least for a couple months. And then some of those would be back. And then unfortunately, some of those would be dead. And, and it was always super, super, it was a tough world. It was a tough world to be in. And it kind of made a lot of ER docs at the time pretty salty, you know, given opioid medications when we know somebody was struggling. That was tough. Now the real answer, why I do what I do. And although that was a real answer too, but this is more of the real answer. I myself, you know, I struggled with alcohol addiction for 12 years of my life. I know exactly how it feels to feel worthless. I know exactly how it feels to not want to wake up the next morning, to realize that today was going to be the exact same awful existence as yesterday. And what's the point? You know, I remember people leaving me and abandoning me because they didn't want to see me hurt myself the way that I was hurting myself. Mm-hmm. I gave up on relationships. I gave up on family. I gave up on myself. Most importantly, I gave up on myself. And so I came into recovery now about 6 years ago, and it has been the most glorious 6 years of my life. I have learned more about I've learned more about myself in the last 6 years than I have any other time that I've been on this planet. For the first time in my life, I don't feel insecure. I don't feel like I'm an imposter. I feel like I have a place and that I have self-worth. And that's a wonderful feeling. And to be honest with you, I want to help other folks understand that as well. And, you know, I say this all the time, you know, the world sees enough of active addiction. They see the media photos of parents passed out in the front seat with their unshackled, unbuckled in 2-year-old in the back seat. They see a lot of that. They see the horrors of active addiction, but what they don't see are the wonders of recovery. And I am super, super open with my own personal recovery. I always have been. I am not a big fan of being anonymous for the simple reason that I think that people need to see that recovery is possible. And if I can get it, I grew up in addiction, in a world of addiction, in my family, and experienced it myself. And if I could be here talking with you guys, working at a just a wonderful place like Landmark Recovery, and being in a field that I love and am passionate about in addiction medicine, then anything's possible. And so, yeah, I mean, hopefully that's not a long-winded answer to your question.
That's a great
answer. Yeah. Super passionate about recovery. And I want everybody, I would love it if everybody could know what it feels like to feel free, you know, to feel free.
Michael, go ahead. I wanted to just go ahead.
Yeah. And I just think, and thank you for that. I think it's so important for people to understand that it's not, you know, the person under the bridge with the brown paper bag. I mean, you and I both know this is a equal opportunity disease, and to hear from someone like you, I think is important. It was funny. I was having surgery one time, and the surgeon was a friend of mine. He's a recovering guy. And, one of the nurses said something to me in pre-op. And I said, yeah, I prefer my doctor not to be up all night drinking.
Absolutely.
And so many people never think about that, you know, and I, you know, as an interventionist, I've had the opportunity to help a number of docs. And, you know, there's so much better and well-rounded, in my opinion, when that self-discovery begins. And, and so, you know, one of the other things we were talking about is, you know, the professional dialogue, these days, not just the general public, but the professional dialogue over what mode of treatment, you know, MAT, other approved treatment forms. You know, oftentimes it dissolves into a debate like religion or politics. How would you suggest, I think it's really important for people who know, you know this personally and professionally, to let other professionals and lay people learn how to sit down and have a conversation at the table right. about what's right for you. Because again, there is no one person, there is no one road out of this. So how do we sit down and just start to have a conversation about what the options are and choosing a proper path for you?
Great question.
No, that's a wonderful question, Michael. And you know, I think some of the best advice I've ever gotten, I had some extra training in addiction medicine in Pittsburgh once I decided to get into this gig. And I think one of the best things that I was ever told was, you know, think of recovery like trying to win a marathon, right? You're running a marathon. And our job as addiction specialists, as people in the field, as clinicians, as therapists, case managers, as peers, as physicians, addiction specialists, doesn't matter. Our job is to kind of get you to the starting line, right? And your job as the person is to run the race. I wish I could run the race for you. I have enough problems running my own race. I can't run your race for you too. But by goodness, I could be there to support you all along the way right. and, you know, cheer for you and do whatever you can or do whatever I can to remove some of those obstacles in your pathway. You know, the wonderful part about this race is that there's not one way to go. There's a lot of different roads you can take. Mm-hmm. The important thing is that you keep moving forward. When you stop, when you start looking back, that's when problems happen. You got to keep moving towards that finish line. And I think that one of the challenges with everybody in recovery is trying to find which road is right for them. And I think that, you know, that's a lot of trial and error. You know, I also had somebody tell me one time, and I use it all the time, you know, think of things in recovery as like you're going into Target and you need to buy a pair of pants. You try on a bunch of different types of pants pair. And if it fits, you take it. If it doesn't fit, you put it back on the rack. And I think that, you know, that's just such an amazing analogy for me.
You get my wife on the show to talk about Target, Dr. Kirby, by the way, just that's why.
No, right. Right. I mean, it's yeah. the only way I can wrap my little brain around it. You know, I'm a pretty simplistic person when it comes to it. And, you know, that makes sense to me. And, you know, and it's okay to try some things. And if they don't work out, you know, try some other things and, you know, find something that works for them. Now, when it comes to, you know, specifically the topic of pharmacotherapy, you know, the medications that surround, you know, this disease, you know, like I was talking with Michael about is, you know, addiction treatment has been around, you know, for 100 years, you know, since the early 1900s. Residential programs have been around since the 1900s right. as well. And, you know, if there's one positive aspect that's come out of this opioid epidemic in the past 10 years, it's been the amount of money that's been soaked into research. You know, for the longest time in addiction medicine, we've just done things because we do things. No rhyme, no reason. There's not a whole lot of evidence behind it. It's just kind of what we've always done. And because of all this research, we're starting to know, hey, this works, this doesn't work. You know, we're starting to gravitate. We're having guidelines being published for the first time ever in our specialty. And we're starting to know and do research on a lot of different topics. You know, we've done this psychosocial, spiritual part of treatment. We've done that super, super well the entire time that we've offered drug and alcohol treatment. But one of the things that we've lacked, and I think that it's because of research behind it, has been the biological approach. You know, the neurochemical transmission, the pathophysiology of the limbic system and what promotes that behavior. You know, what neurochemicals are responsible for that behavior, and why can't some of our biology, our anatomy and our brains that are supposed to tell us to stop, you know, why aren't they utilized? And so what we're finding is that there is a massive change that happens inside the brain with folks who suffer from these use disorders. And it doesn't matter which use disorder it is. Anything that's psychoactive, anything that affects these neurochemicals will trigger this exact same pathway. And what we find is that, you know, this release of these neurochemicals are so stimulating because they feel so good that eventually people will, their only motivation, their only survival technique is more of the substance. And so what used to be these healthy behaviors, you know, 100,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago, when we're just crawling out of caves and hunting saber-toothed tigers, you know, when we eat that meat, you know, we feel good, we feel satiated, you know, we're going to live another day, we feel good. It releases these happy chemicals. And that's a way to keep our species thriving on this earth. Well, now those healthy activities that we had engaged in are pushed to the side. And the only thing driving our survival now is that substance. And so specifically revolving around opioids, because that's kind of the topic of the decade, you know, opioid addiction, I would argue, although it affects the brain in the exact same way, as far as neurochemical release, behaviors we see are different. And one of the things about opioids is we don't have time to kind of mess around with folks who use opioids. You know, every time someone sticks a needle in their arm, I mean, that might be the last. It's Russian roulette every single time. Yeah.
Especially with the fentanyl.
Right, because of fentanyl, right. That's the majority of what we're seeing on the streets now is fentanyl from China and India. And it's so powerful, so potent, even to people who have this tolerance for opioids, that it could be a one and done. And so my point is that, you know, medicines and pharmacotherapy specifically surrounding opioids are help to calm down that craving to use, that drive, that limbic system, that motivation to use, calm down those cravings. But at the same time, buprenorphine and methadone also have characteristics that it actually protects somebody against an overdose. The way that it binds to the receptors in the brain make it very difficult for fentanyl molecules to kick those off those receptors, thereby actually enhancing diminishing the risk of overdose. And so there's intrinsic properties that we now know that we didn't know 10 years ago. So around pharmacotherapy, my point in saying all that is that, you know, we know more now than we did 5 years ago. And we'll probably know more in 5 years than we do now. And what we're trying to promote now in addiction medicine is the utilization of all four aspects of wellness, right? To make sure that we're not leaving out the biological and promoting the rest of them, that we're optimizing complete well-being. We're balancing these neurochemicals at the same time we're working on somebody's trauma history or we're working on somebody's spiritual depletion, right? We're doing everything possible to promote the growth of the person, not necessarily not just using a substance, because that's the easy part, right?
Yeah, and that's great points. The next question I love, Zach, I don't know if it was yours or mine, but I'm going to grab it because it's something I've thought about a long time.
Before you ask that, Michael, I want to ask you a question, Dr. Kirby, because going back to the piece that you mentioned about, you know, the survival, right? When people are using opioids, you know, it's sort of their survival, you know, mechanism, you know, they don't. And I know that anhedonia is a big piece of when people stop using opioids, that's kind of what settles in, right? And it's a powerful effect on the person who's, you know, trying to get better. You know, they may be stopped, but their inability to stay stopped over the course of days, weeks, months, years is very sort of compromised by this anhedonia, right? Can you explain to our audience what anhedonia means in maybe a neurochemical sort of way?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thank you, Zach. That's a wonderful opportunity to talk about this. So there have been a lot of studies done on the different types of substances and the dopamine drive that's associated with it. So dopamine is a neurochemical that's specifically the neurochemical of choice in addiction. That's what drives our limbic system, our brain, our reward motivation center. That's the driver of the boat, right? So every substance that's psychoactive will release a certain amount of dopamine. So exercise, sex, rearing children, breastfeeding, all these healthy activities will release dopamine. You know, you go on a long run and you kind of feel a little high after it, right? Well, that's the dopamine drive. And what that's supposed to do, that's your body trying to say, you know what, Michael, Zach, I love that we just went for a 3-mile run, man. I feel so good. I want to do that again, man. Yeah. So that feeling good is supposed to promote, hey, man, I feel good. I want to feel good again. You know, the limbic system is by far my favorite system that we have in our body because it's so simplistic. If it feels good, I'm going to do it again. And if it doesn't feel good, then I won't do it again. And that's how our species, every species on this earth, it has been surviving, because if you go up to a bear and poke it with a stick and the bear mauls you, right, and you survive that, you're probably not going to do that again, right? So, you know, and that's your limbic system telling you, hey, if you want to be around to make more of your species, you're not going to do that stupid stuff. Well, the interesting part about substance use is that, you know, it hijacks the system. And it's completely 180 degrees from our survival techniques. You know, instead of food, clothing, all the good things that we need in order to survive, we give up all of those just for more of the substance. But back to your point, Zach. So what happens is there have been a lot of functional MRI studies that have looked at different substances. I'll talk about methamphetamines first. Methamphetamine releases 10,000 times the dopamine per unit per molecule than these healthy activities do. 10,000 wow. times, right? So imagine that for however many years you've been using methamphetamine, every time to a certain point, you know, you've been having this a massive amount of dopamine dump, this massive drive of dopamine. And then all of a sudden, that's gone. So you're in treatment now. You're in a residential program. And you're not getting that massive dump of dopamine and this anhedonia, this just kind of bleh feeling, right? That's really what it is. You know, just a bleh. I just feel, bleh. You know, I don't feel depressed. I don't feel awful. I just don't feel anything. Right. And a part of that is because your feel good neurochemical is not regulated yet. It's still, you know, to your brain, it's used to having this massive amount of dopamine dumped on it. Now it's not. And so I hear a lot of folks and I experienced it myself when I got sober. The first probably 6 months in my recovery, I just didn't feel much of anything. I just mm-hmm. kind of existed. And I had to kind of trust the process. And I think that was one of the things that I learned in my program. It may not feel good today, but it may feel good tomorrow. And if I want that, if I want the opportunity to feel good tomorrow, then I have to keep the course today. And so, you know, methamphetamine releases 10,000 times. Opioids aren't quite as much. Alcohol isn't quite as much. But every psychoactive substance will release a certain amount of dopamine. So it's to be expected that everybody who suffers from this disease, whenever they are in remission, they're going to have some aspect of just, you know, I just don't feel good. You know, sex doesn't feel as good. I feel fatigued all the time. My energy levels are low. I don't want to exercise. I don't want to work out. I don't want to take care of myself. How can we, as a treatment community, push people past that? You know, one of the things I think that get us people in recovery kind of backtrack, going back to the analogy of the race, looking back, is this immediate gratification. Well, I don't want to be uncomfortable now. I always have to be comfortable. So I'm going to do whatever I have to do now in order to not be uncomfortable. And I think that the more that we can promote, hey, delayed gratification, if you just keep doing the things you need to do now, eventually things will turn out well, right? In 12-step, we use, you know, it's, you know, the, you know, following the path that the big book says, right? I mean, you know, that trudge the
happy destiny.
The happy destiny, right? You know, so we as a community needs to say, you know, you may not feel good today, but just hold on, keep doing the things that you're doing because you're doing a great job. Tomorrow, you may feel good. So don't give up on today. Don't give up on the possibility tomorrow because you don't feel good today, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the opportunities, as we talked earlier, that Matt will give a lot of these young addicts that don't feel good and are likely to go out and use again, that if they're on the medication and they can't get high, we may keep them alive long enough to get them to that point where they're willing to stick around like we've learned to do, get through those bad spots. I love that you're talking about the brain research, and there is so much coming out on that. Maybe we'll do another podcast. I was just reading a study on internet and gaming addiction and massive rushes of dopamine that they're seeing from that is frightening. But to get to the next question, because again, this is one I love, talking about medical students, you know, and physicians and other specialties. I mean, personally, it's been a pet peeve back to, you know, 20 something years ago, we used to do these physician in residence programs at a program I worked for where any doctor could come in and spend a couple of days on campus learning about addiction medicine, learning about treatment and recovery and all that. I know there are some medical schools that take it a lot more seriously now, but there's still so many places where it's an afterthought. What's the benefit from your perspective, any medical student seeking this, whether it's presented to them or not? Because, you know, some of the schools now, if you really want to learn it, you can. But if you don't, you don't have to. And I just think it's so important for any specialty because, you know, if you're seeing patients for anything, you're seeing people who are in need.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, the thing about it, I remember my medical school, and I love my medical school, by the way. But, you know, when I was going through medical school, you know, addiction was still fairly stigmatized. And I think I got maybe a total of 2 or 3 hours talking about addiction during one of my psychology months. And, you know, when I was a third year or fourth year student doing my rotations, you know, it was, there was nothing ever formally presented. I don't remember any formal didactics. And, you know, to your point, Michael, I think it's gotten a whole lot better now. We as a specialty, we as a physician's whole realize the gravity of the situation. We're starting to understand addiction as a disease and not necessarily something like a moral failing that, that it's, you know, it's very, very, it's very, very similar to the disease concept of diabetes, and in which, you know, it's partially driven by behaviors, right? I mean, it's the things we choose to do, things we choose to consume, behaviors we choose to exhibit, and, you know, very, very similar to diabetes. So, you know, so I think that one of the things that I've been super excited about in the last, well, 5 years now, you know, addiction medicine before 2017 was fairly unregulated. There was, you know, there was a loose kind of association, but starting in 2017, the American Board of Preventive Medicines recognized addiction medicine as one of its subspecialties, and so starting in 2017, physicians with the appropriate training and the appropriate experience could now get board certified in addiction medicine to prove that they really knew about this disease. I say it all the time. I say it to my team all the time. You know, there's a difference between people who understand this disease and physicians who prescribe medications for this disease. I think they're two totally different things.
Totally.
And we need more physicians who understand this disease. We need to promote addiction medicine along with cardiology and gastroenterology and endocrinology and the rest of the ologies to medical students and make it attractive, right? I mean, it's a really tough day. It's a tough subset of people, myself included. I didn't necessarily, it took me a little bit of time to get it. But I tell you, the rewards of doing this work, at least for me, have been amazing. And I wouldn't trade a single day or a single patient. They've been hard. It's been challenging for sure. And not always a win at the end of the day. But I tell you, I wouldn't do anything differently. And so we need better curriculum in medical schools. We need more curriculum in all the residencies. Every single residency needs to understand a portion of addiction, because 28 million Americans right now suffer from this use disorder. 10% of folks use an opioid. 10% of folks who drink a drop of alcohol will develop compulsive use tendencies that will reflect criteria for a use disorder. They are already their patients. They just don't know it yet because they're not asking the question, right? Well, so they need to know how to identify it. They need to know how to get them to people like me when they do identify it. And there needs to be more fellowships in addiction medicine. We're doing a fantastic job cranking them out, but there needs to be more.
I was going to say, I really appreciate that perspective, because, you know, the piece that I think that doctors and just lay people in general, I think probably need to get away from is this idea of, you know, you kind of made your bed, now you sleep in it, right? With regard to addiction, because, you know, at some point you lose the ability to choose, right? It chooses you, right? Yeah. And it kind of leads me into the next question, really, which is, you know, with a lot of MAT programs, some of them very good, some of them not good at all, right? How do you plan or hope to plan to implement an effective MAT program at Landmark? I guess, you know, what'll be different, so to speak, than say other MAT programs?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I think that attracted me to the position is Landmark's willingness to really promote evidence-based outcomes-oriented medicine, because that's really at the very core of who I am. You know, I want to do stuff that actually makes a difference, right? I want to make sure that the medicine that I'm practicing is the best medicine that I could potentially offer, that the science is backed, that we know has an effect. And like I said, you know, there's not a whole lot of pharmacotherapy right now for these use disorders that have been shown to be super, super effective, except for, you know, specifically revolve around buprenorphine, naltrexone, and methadone. And so, so I think that what I would like to bring to the organization is I want to foster that evidence-based approach. I want to foster that outcomes-oriented type of approach where we're gonna follow the science. We're going to incorporate this into a complete treatment plan. We are not going to dictate and say, well, pharmacotherapy is the only way to go. No, we are going to incorporate pharmacotherapy if indicated into the patient's complete recovery plan. And so, you know, it's going to be offered. It's going to, we're going to utilize our treatment teams to make sure that we identify the right people. And most importantly for me, I want to make sure that my team, the providers who operate in our facilities, are very, very well educated. The next 12 months of my life, I'm going to be recruiting new medical directors for our new facilities. They will all be addiction specialists. I'm going to be looking for those folks. They're all going to have management experience. Cool. They're all going to know about this disease, and they're going to be able to educate their team, their boots on the ground teams of providers, about the evidence-based outcomes-oriented approaches. So at the end of the day, we're not getting a bunch of physicians who kind of sling buprenorphine. We're getting addiction specialists who can work inside that interdisciplinary team to give folks the best option going forward. That's my hope. That's what I want to bring. So,
sounds like a tool in the toolbox rather than the only plan.
Yeah. Right.
And my understanding of the research is that's the way it's supposed to be used. So that I'm really psyched about that. I'm looking forward to working
with you. Me too.
Right. Very cool. And I love that analogy too, Michael, that I use that too. You know, it's, imagine recovery like you're trying to build a big, beautiful house, right? In order to build that house, you have to have as many tools as possible, right? And buprenorphine is a wonderful hammer, but you need more than a hammer to build a house, right? Absolutely. But having said that, it's really hard to build a house without a hammer.
Without a hammer.
Right? So, our goal, again, I think as treatment specialists, as people who take care of these folks, is to try to encourage and motivate them to find as many tools in order to build that house as possible. So I love your analogy.
Love it. You know what, I guess, you know, Mike, I was thinking too about, you know, when someone goes into a MAT program or even treatment for that matter, what would you say, Dr. Kirby, would be a sort of litmus test, or, you know, when someone is an excellent candidate for versus maybe a good fit for our new MAT program, what would be the criterion that you consider to be sort of front and center for admission into the OBOT program?
Well, I think, you know, I think that they have to, you know, I think that anybody who falls into that moderate to high risk category, right? I think those are the folks that, again, I said it before, we don't have a whole lot of time to mess around. Mm-hmm. Because if they go out and put a needle in their arm, that may be the last, right? So we want to try to do it right from the very get-go. Alcohol actually kills a whole lot more folks than opioids, but we don't talk about that quite as much because it takes 20 years to kill you, right? As opposed to that one time. And so, you know, anyone who's survived an overdose, anyone who's had multiple overdoses, whether they've been revived with Narcan or not, I think, well, I absolutely know are candidates. You know, folks who have tried to do it other ways, right? They've been in Target, they put on a couple different pairs of pants and it just hasn't fit, right? They just can't find something that works. You know, I think those are folks too. You know, folks who, you know, have a really, you know, compulsive type of personality where they're, you know, they have to do things in order to feel good. We're not necessarily surrounding that substance, but there are compulsive tendencies in personality. So personalities that are compulsive anyway will make the compulsive parts of addiction even tougher. So that's helpful. But yeah, high risk folks, I think that folks, you know, the bar is set not super, super low, but I mean, low enough where, folks, you know, will get the benefit of the doubt for the most part. You know, is this medicine warranted? Could mm-hmm. this medicine be potentially helpful versus not? And I'm not, and it's not just buprenorphine, you know, this also naltrexone falls into this as well. Naltrexone has a lot of good evidence, surrounding it as well. And it works a little bit differently in the brain, with these neurochemicals, but the same effect. It basically calms down the cravings and makes it a little bit less fun, to do the real stuff. And so, you know, it's, you know, again, in and of itself, pharmacotherapy is not a recovery program, but it's, as Mike said, it's a wonderful tool that we can use. So, you know, it's going to be up to the providers at the facilities, but also the clinicians, the case managers, the peers, everybody who's involved, the stakeholders, you know, the wives and husbands, the probation officers and the drug court judges. I mean, all these people have a say in that person's life. And I think that this needs to be a group decision. You know, how can we best move forward and give this person the best shot possible? At the end of the day, my favorite word when I talk about folks in recovery is functionality. What gives folks the best chance to be more functional, right? And so, you know, I'm sure you guys have met folks too. I've met folks in the rooms of 12-step. You know, they may not be drinking, they may not be drugging, but man, they're miserable people. And
there was a saying early on in the rooms in Florida that I remember a guy said, you sober up a horse thief, you get a sober horse thief.
right. You know, and so, you know, it's so it's absolutely. So, you know, the easy part is giving up the substance. The harder part is trying to find who you are, rediscover your values, mm-hmm. your ethics. And right. and if medication can make that process easier, if it makes you more functional, if you're going back to school, you're getting your kids back, you're getting off of probation, mm-hmm. getting out of jail, you know, getting transportation, getting a house, you know, you're being more functional, then that's a positive effect. That's what we want to see.
I want to go back to something at the very first part of this interview that we talked about. And you brought it up, I think, in your intro. You talked about moving away, right, from yourself feeling like you were an imposter, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I want to ask you a question about, and I've heard this come up in different ways, at least for people who are on an MAT program, is that they sometimes feel as though they're an imposter to recovery, right?
Yes.
Where they're not really in recovery, right? There's still that piece, you know, that they have, you know, that is MAT. What do you say to those people who have that belief or just in general people who hold that belief?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, and I've said it before, and I'll preface what I'm going to say by saying I love recovery, and I love who I've met in recovery, 99% of them. And I love the programs that I would not be here without the people who have supported me and the programs that I went to support. But I will say one of the things that can potentially be negative to folks who use substances are people who are in recovery. And I hate to say that, but there's still a stigma kind of surrounding, these medications, and I completely get it. But at the end of the day, if that's being promoted to these folks that, you're not in real recovery unless you're completely sober. Well, what if being completely sober has led to 5 overdoses and they're barely alive by the skin of their teeth, right? I mean, right. They're just setting themselves up for that 6th overdose, but, by God, they're going to keep doing it. What's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? We got to try to change things up. Going back to my ER doc days, I have heard so many times when I broach this topic to my personal patients, what do you think about maybe giving this medicine a try? Nah, doc, I don't want a crutch. That's a crutch.
Right.
Well, to me, all right. So if you break your leg, right, and you come into my emergency room, what am I going to do? I'm going to do some X-rays. Let's say, yep, X-ray shows that your leg's broken. What's the next thing I do? I'm going to put a brace on your leg, right? I'm going to give you some crutches to walk. Why am I doing that? Well, because you need this temporarily to be more functional, right? For you to get around, for you to do the things you need to do. Unfortunately, you're going to need some help. Now, it won't be forever probably, but you need some help for a period of time. What's wrong with that? When did having a brace on your leg and some crutches for a broken leg become such a negative thing? And I think that it's not. And I think that you ask any rational person that they'll probably tell you the same thing. So why is it different when we talk about substance use disorders and treatment for substance use disorders? And the word comes down to stigma. So, I love crutches. I think that if anything to help you be, again, more functional is kind of the name of the game. And, the thing, I think that one of the things that gets misinterpreted with these medicines is, they don't want to be on it forever. And I get that, it's not a medicine that necessarily you have to be on forever. I know plenty of folks. I've treated thousands of people with opioid use disorder in my career, thousands. There are some folks, unfortunately, that are more functional on this medicine, and that's okay. Whatever they need to be more functional. But I know a ton of folks, more folks than not, who have been able to find themselves, establish who they are, establish themselves in society as they see themselves. Mm-hmm. And when they're at a place where they're ready, they can start to ask the question, well, what would my life, what would my recovery look like without these medicines? And I help them through that. That's my job. And so, I would love to get to a point where we as a recovery community can stop chastising folks for their decisions to make them more functional, right? If it's hurting them, that's one thing. But if it's actually improving their lives and they're getting back some of the aspects that they've lost, then that's not in and of itself a bad thing. And I think that's I've also heard the term, well, I don't want to become addicted to buprenorphine. Well, think about it. So the definition of addiction, if you break down the definition of addiction, what is it? Well, it's use despite negative consequences, right? So if you're taking buprenorphine and you've gotten your kids back from CPS and you've gotten out of drug court and you've done your probation and your wife or your husband's come back home and you've gotten a job and you've gotten a stable place to live and you bought a car, I would argue that your life is better. And so in and of itself, that actually negates that definition of addiction, right? Use despite negative consequences. So that's the way that I look at it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Sounds like we've got enough ammunition here for another podcast, because I agree with you. I go back to your equating it to treating diabetes. I mean, changes over time. You increase your overall health. You're not going to be treated with the same doses and possibly even get to the point where you don't need insulin. I mean, everybody's different. So we've got to treat this as a chronic disease, not an acute episode, and continue to educate not only our patients, but the general public. Because, you know, right. When you were talking about the Zach, you know, these kids coming in and not feeling like they belong because of mm-hmm. it. It reminds me early on being at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with an old timer, and a guy came in and said, I'm an addict. And one of the old timers said, you need to go find an AA meeting. And the other old timer said, do you have a desire not to drink today? And the guy said, yes. And he said, you can stay. So, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think that I would like to see us continue this podcast and some other things that we do at Landmark and start to broaden that conversation, because there are a lot of things people say that aren't necessarily true. So I'm looking forward to working with you. I think this has been a great topic. I think that we can continue to talk about it and educate and help more people.
Right. Dr. Kirby, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been fantastic.
Thank you guys.
Yeah. Mike, I was just thinking, you know, we want to take this moment to let you know also that if you're ready to live beyond your addictions, you can start today. You can visit us at landmarkrecovery.com, or you can give one of our recovery specialists a phone call at 888-448-0302. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And as always, everyone, thank you for listening. Be sure to meet us right back here next Tuesday. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time, with all episodes available on demand on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you dreamed on the road to recovery.